Let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, You are heavenly. You're the one who created all things. You're the author of all things, and therefore You have authority over all things. And You reign and rule now through the risen Lord Jesus Christ, whom You granted authority over heaven and earth. And I pray that You'd give us wisdom in thinking about how He reigns and rules over the civil government. We know that there is not one square inch outside of His authority. And we live in a republic. I pray that You'd give us wisdom from the Romans as our Christian founders of America look to their example and to their republic for insights in constructing the U.S. Constitution and the federal government and our federal system in this republic of the United States of America, under Your authority and for Your glory. We pray that You'd bless our class today. We pray, dear Lord, that You would rebuild our ruins and restore our race. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, today we continue our topic looking at the Roman Republic that we introduced the last time we met. The last time we began our journey through Rome. As you know, in our course, we're traveling through Western civilization to America, and we began with Jerusalem, and then traveled through Athens and ancient Greece, and then now to Rome, and then, Lord willing, onward to London and to America. And the reason the Greeks in Athens and the Romans are included is because that's where republican forms of government began, as we noted in Athens. But it was really in Rome that the American founders looked to more than Athens. And we'll talk a little bit about that today. We introduced the legend, the myth of the founding of Rome in 753 BC, with Romulus and Remus being suckled by a she-wolf, and how that began in their mythology. And we looked at the 250-year period under seven kings from 753 to 509 BC. And we noted that even though it was monarchs, there were seven kings that ruled in that 250-year period of time, that you could call it, though, an aristocratic monarchy, because the way things functioned is the Senate had a dominant place with the monarch. You remember Senex is the Latin word for old men. Old man. And it was of the patricians, the leading old men of the wealthy landowning families, patricians, and they were the ones who comprised the Senate. And no proposal for a law could become law by the king or by the assembly. The assembly was all of the younger patricians, of the male citizens. The assembly could propose a bill to become law, or the king could, but it had to go through confirmation of the Senate. And you remember that a king could nominate a successor after him, and if he didn't, then the Senate would propose a successor, but the king could not be approved unless voted on by the assembly. So you had these various separation of powers and checks and balances even within their monarchs, their monarchies. We had noted when they formed the Roman Republic in 509 BC, they basically did it overnight, because really the only change they made was replacing the king with two consulars. You remember the Centurium Assembly, which met in non-regular times. The military units were called centuries. So the Centurium Assembly was of the military units within the Roman military, and they're the ones that elected the two counselors to replace the monarch with the imperium power, they called it. The imperium power is the power of the monarch. He was commander-in-chief, in charge of the religion as well. He made declarations of war and of peace. But the two counselors then had that imperial power that had been with the king, but were then elected by the military units, the Centurion Assembly. So they were electing their own commanders-in-chief, the two commanders-in-chief. Now, it's very important when we begin to think about the Roman Republic, because that's really where the American founders looked to for a model and example. Because it lasted over 400 years, very successful, and as well, very expansive over a very broad area, which you did not find in Athens. And we will see there are things that resemble in our constitutional system the Roman Republic. But the Republic, as we noted last time we met in Rome, was a aristocratic republic. The two consulars had to be members of the Senate. So really, it was the Senate that really still controlled things. And therefore, it's called an aristocratic republic. Aristocrats are where the wealthy few are doing what's best for everyone. If they're ruling for their own selfish ends, then it's an oligarchy. Okay, we've covered that in the past, but that's review. So a true aristocracy is where you have the wealthy few governing for the good of all. But an oligarchy is where the wealthy few govern only for themselves. One could argue, certainly, that what made the Roman Republic last so long was a noble aristocracy within the Roman Republic. We had noted, just for a quick review as well, after the Roman Republic was founded, 509 BC, removing the monarch, establishing the two consulars, electing them, then the plebes, you remember the plebes were the poor, many of them poor farmers as well, but they were not the patricians. Well, they wanted an assembly of their own, and they demanded it in 494. So the Republic founded 509. By 494, they're demanding their own assembly. They're granted permission, and it was formalized in 471 BC that the plebes had their own concilium plebis, their own assembly, their own convention of plebes in 471 BC. 20 years after that, we had noted that they demanded a board of 10 officials, the decemviri, a board of 10 officials to publish a written code of laws, which they did not have prior to that point. The plebes say, we want the rule of law and we want it written out, what our rights are within the Roman Republic. And that was granted. 3 of the 10 officials, we noted, traveled to Athens, and 3 of the 10 officials then coming back from Athens came back with copies of Solon's laws that he had written in his reforms in 594 BC, over 100 years prior. And remember, he is the one, he was a poet, but he had wisdom, Solon did, and the American founders studied Solon as well in his reforms early in Athens, because they're beginning a republic. And in the beginning of the republic, you want to study, okay, who was successful at the beginning of a republic? Well, Solon was in establishing the golden age of Athens in his reforms within Athens and their republic. So his laws helped balance. There was tension, economic tension between the various economic classes. Well, he helped balance things. You know, you don't want all wealth in just a few hands. You've got to distribute the wealth somehow, and the laws have to manage debt, so not everybody's going in enslavement because of debt. So the burdensome of debt and all of that, and he was able to balance that. Well, that's where they came back with his laws, and that helped them write the famous 12 tables. And there are remnants of that that survive to today, just as Solon's laws as well to today. Covered everything from property rights, slaves, marriage, divorce, inheritance, punishment, all sorts of different things. But you had the rule of law, a written code, which you had in Israel as well, as we noted in Jerusalem. It's something unique with Western civilization, the rule of law, a written code governing all people. Well, this is where we pick up today then, is with the expansion of the Roman Republic. How did it begin, really, in a fairly small area where it did have some cities that the kingdom of Rome had conquered around them in the plains of Italy, in the central plains of Italy, that they had to govern, but it was still pretty small. Well, how did it go from there to expanding so great that it would eventually control the entire Mediterranean area, even east of Israel and Asia, Western Europe through France, even up to Britain? All the Mediterranean, Western Europe, all the way to Britain, and part of Asia and Southeast Europe and Macedonia. All of it. At one point, it controlled at its height. And what we're going to cover today is how it expanded to that great point, and then looking at its decline, at its very peak is when it began to decline, at the late days of the Republic. So we're going to basically cover over 400 years here today of the Roman Republic, and essentially end with Cicero. And that's where next class, Lord willing, we'll pick up with Cicero and his analysis living in the decline of the Roman Republic and his view of order and the law of nature. And it was very influential as well to the American founders who read Cicero, his writings. Okay, so that's kind of the layout of where we're going today. We're going to cover a lot, but I'm trying to lay it out chronologically as well as the major events and wars, but their strategy as well, their policy of expanding. How did they do it? Now, the American founders paid more attention to the Roman Republic than they did to the Greek cities because they perceived that the Roman Republic resembled more of America, a very expansive territory. It's going to be large. With the Greeks, the Greek polis, the Greek community, the Greek political republic was compact in territory. They were all small, and their populations were small, just a few thousand, maybe 7,000 to 10,000 people. And the American founders thought then that that could not be imitated successfully on a sprawling expanse of the American Republic. But the Roman Senate was a different, that was a whole different matter. The Roman Senate, the Roman Republic, the American founders believed could be replicated in America, because it expanded so broadly and was very successful. Russell Kirk, he was a political scientist in the 20th century. I think he died, I think it was 1994, right in that period of time in the early 90s. He wrote that what is called by historians the Great Age of Athens lasted less than 50 years. But the American founders looked for greater permanence, and they found it in the Roman Republic that lasted over 400 years. So the Golden Age of Athens, remember it was in the early 5th century, they had the Persian Wars, they had the Delian League of Greek city-states that they led that helped defeat the Persians, 490, 480 BC in a couple different wars. Their golden period there was about 50 years, and they were in the middle of, then of this long 27-year Peloponnesian War against Sparta from 431 to 404 BC, in which they lost and were totally decimated, Athens. There were nothing after that, really. So their golden age of their republic only lasted about 50 years, maybe you could say 480 to 430 BC. But the Roman Republic is a whole different animal. You look at that and you go, this is a successful republic that lasted a very long time. This is something where we can gain lots of wisdom from. And the American founders looked then to the Roman Republic more than Athens. So our question then is, how did the Roman Republic expand and survive for over 400 years? And really it came down to this, that Rome made key alliances. They were very good in diplomatic affairs. They won several wars and granted unique forms of citizenship. We noted that in 509 BC, when the Republic was founded in Rome, that same year, they formed a treaty with Carthage. Carthage was a city on the Mediterranean coast, northwest Africa, south of Sicily, south of Italy. Carthage formed a treaty with them at that point, saying they could be a military enemy to us, and Rome looked at them and said they could be a military enemy to us. There were Phoenicians had founded Carthage many years before from Tyre and Sidon over there north of Israel. But Carthage at that time posed a threat, a military threat to Rome, as well as Rome to Carthage. So they formed a treaty in 509 BC between each other. But Carthage was not the only military threat to Rome. The history of Rome then in the 400s, the 5th century, just after founding the Republic, it was dominated in that century by wars with two peoples within ancient Italy, the Volsci and the Aquii, two tribal groups within Italy at that time. Rome eventually won both those long and grueling wars by the beginning of the 4th century BC, by the beginning of the 300s. And it provided more farmland for the plebs, who had complained repeatedly of famine during the 400s, during the 5th century BC. So winning those two long wars between these other two tribal groups in central Italy helped provide more farmland for the plebs within the Roman Republic. In 390 BC, it's a very important year, a large Gallic, a large French, at that time it was the Gauls, present-day France, but a large Gallic army came down from the north and beat the Roman army that was just north of the city, and then they went down into the city of Rome and plundered it in 390 BC. Now, after they plundered it of wealth, meaning they stole whatever wealth was there, the Gauls destroyed and burned the city of Rome in 390 BC, and they occupied it for 7 months. And they only left after being paid a very massive ransom. So they plundered it of all the wealth in the city of Rome, burned everything, they destroyed everything, and then occupied it for 7 months. So we're not leaving either unless whatever Romans are around here pay us a huge ransom. Now the Romans did pay them, but eventually the Romans recovered their money by military force. You say, well, how serious was this defeat of the city of Rome in 390 BC? Interestingly, it was the only documented time when the city of Rome was captured by a hostile power before the Goth-Illyric tribal group of the Germanic tribe in 410 AD sacked Rome, when the western part of Rome fell in 410 AD. 390 BC to 410 AD. So the city of Rome did not fall again for about 800 years. And this is a period of time at this time where there's nothing but war all around, all the time, between tribal groups. So it's very significant, because we in our own minds, many of you know that the city of Rome fell by the Germanic tribes in 410 AD. That was a momentous moment. And then Rome continued on through Constantinople in the east. The eastern part of the Roman Empire continued on for 1,000 years. But the west fell in 410 AD to the Germanic tribes. But it was 800 years earlier in 390 BC where this happened once, where the French, the Gallic army came down and sacked Rome. Amazingly, though, most of the plebs within the city of Rome in 390 BC, they successfully left before the Gauls arrived and quickly resettled the city after the Gauls left. Most of the plebs survived it by immediately fleeing. In the 300s, the 4th century BC, the 300s, there was the Latin War, it's called, the Latin War between Rome and other ancient Italian cities. The Latin War occurred between 341 and 338 BC. And that war is significant because it led to some significant changes in how Rome enlarged its territorial jurisdiction. So jurisdiction, just so you're aware, jurisdiction, juris, law, diction, to speak. So literally, jurisdiction means the authority to speak the law. So if you govern an area, you have jurisdiction over it. You have the authority to speak the law. Now, I'm a Minnesota citizen. If I have had no minimum contacts to South Dakota, never sent anything to them, never mailed anything to them, never traveled there, never touched the state at all, never even called there, never emailed there, never done anything there, no minimum contacts, that means that a South Dakota court has no jurisdiction over me, ever. They do not have the authority to speak the law to me. Now, it's different if I travel over there with my car and get in a car accident. All of a sudden, I'm in their jurisdiction by minimum contacts, and then therefore I can be sued in a South Dakota court, and the court has authority to speak the law to me. They would have jurisdiction to me because I put myself under their authority. Okay? So when we speak of Rome here, the Roman Republic, expanding their jurisdictional authority, meaning they're conquering more, and the rule of their law is governing more and more people. That's what's happening. More and more tribal groups within Italy. Now, Rome won the Latin War between 341 and 338 BC, between several Italian cities. So they're enlarging their republic within Italy at this point. Before that point, just to let you know, before that point, before the Latin War, there was a Latin League of tribal cities. A Latin League of tribal cities within ancient Italy that were in political alliance with Rome. But Rome had defined each of them according to their own tribal community organization. So within the Latin League, they'd look at them and say, well, what tribe are you and how do you organize yourself? And what tribe are you and how do you organize yourself? And tribe A, B, C, and D. And they were defined by Rome according to what tribe they were and how they organized themselves. Now, at this point, after the Latin War, the republic is growing. You say, well, how are we going to govern this? More and more tribal groups are under our jurisdiction, under our authority, under our legal system. But how do we govern them? I mean, this is a very ancient period of time. This isn't with modern computers and all the rest to try and govern a big group, right? So how do you do it? Well, after the Latin War in 338 BC, having won the war, having now growing their republic to such a stage, like we've got to change our policy with how we define these people groups that are under our authority. And the Roman Senate, we primarily, remember, it's primarily an aristocratic republic. The Senate's leading the way. The few wealthy old men in the Senate doing what's best for the whole republic. Well, they're expanding to such an extent then that the Roman Senate wisely decided to classify all cities by their relationships to Rome, not by their tribal community organizations, but by their relationship to Rome. And this is how Rome thereafter controlled conquered territories. And it will play a role, just to let you know, it will play a role thinking about this to say the U.S. Constitution lays out procedures for growing the U.S. Republic. How we expand with territories and how territories can meet certain qualifications and then apply for statehood. Okay? So how you expand and how they're defined in their relationship to the U.S. Republic. You see? So there's this idea then within the American founders, say, how did Rome do it? How can we do it? Well, lay out three things here, three parts of this policy then. First, some cities were directly incorporated into the Roman state as Roman colonies. Essentially, you're giving them full citizenship. They're directly incorporated into the Roman state as Roman colonies. Giving them full citizenship. It's interesting that the victorious Roman generals and their soldiers controlled the distribution of land while setting up the new colonies. To the victor goes the spoils. And it was to the Roman generals, military generals, and the soldiers who got to control the distribution of land, how that worked. But in first here, they would directly incorporate some of the cities as Roman colonies, essentially giving full citizenship. Secondly, some of the cities further away from Rome were given citizenship without the vote. Citizenship without the vote. It's a very innovative status. It's something unique in history that the Roman Senate came up with in the Roman Republic. Though lacking the right to vote, these, in a sense, lesser citizens were blessed with certain privileges. As a citizen, you have privileges. We speak of the Privileges and Immunities Clause in the U.S. Constitution. We have certain privileges as citizens. Well, they had privileges. They had the protection then of Roman law and Roman courts and the Roman military. Even though they couldn't vote, you're still protected by Roman law, Roman courts, Roman military. As well, there's duties, not just privileges, but duties with citizenship, even though it's non-voting. You could say the price for these privileges were the certain corresponding duties. And the burdens, these duties, were legionary service, being a part of the Roman legions, military service. And then the payment of tributum, the Roman basic Roman tax. So duties, what duties do we have as citizens? Pay a tax, and typically military service. Privileges? Roman law. The Apostle Paul asserted that beautifully when he had dual citizenship. And he asserted his rights as a Roman citizen, appealed to the rights of Rome. Protection of Roman law, protection of Roman courts, protection of Roman military. Privileges. Now, just to let you know as a side note, the basic Roman tax, the tributum, is thought to have been instituted around 400 BC. To finance army pay. To finance army pay. Just over 100 years after the formation of the Republic, where they came up with this idea of the tributum, having these conquered cities pay a tax to help pay, help finance the army, and help pay the army. Okay, so the first one again, directly incorporating some cities into the Roman state as Roman colonies. Secondly, some of the cities further away that they would conquer, they granted non-voting citizenship. Non-voting citizenship. Thirdly, there were other cities that they conquered, they referred to as Latin colonies, that kept the traditional Latin rights, referred to as concubium, the right to marry a Roman citizen, commercium, the right to trade and conduct business with Rome, and migration, the right of migration within the areas controlled by Rome. Those were the traditional Latin rites. So some of them then, in a sense, didn't get even non-voting citizenship, but they had to retain the traditional Latin rites. That's how they related to Rome. Some were given full citizenship, directly incorporated. Others were given further away non-voting citizenship, given some privileges, some duties. And then there were others within Italy that had retained the Latin rites. They were conquered, but they weren't a part of Rome technically, but they retained the Latin rites of those three, concubium, commercium, and migration. Now, think about it. Rome created an idea of citizenship more flexible than anything in ancient Greece. In ancient Greece, citizen or not. Remember, a citizen is one who's committed to the common good. Committed to the common good. And that typically meant you had a right to vote in Greece. Full citizen. You just had citizenship. That meant you were a male and you voted and you were also a soldier. All citizens were soldiers in the Greek republics. Well, here there's this idea of, well, let's grant non-voting citizenship to some of them. So with distinguishing between voting citizenship and non-voting citizenship, Rome also granted dual citizenship, something unique. They were very creative, the Roman Senate. They granted dual citizenship to the residents of incorporated city-states, called municipia. Now think about this a minute. You're in an ancient culture. You don't have cell phones to call immediately somewhere, right, and deal with the situation. Communication takes time. It's hard to control things further away. So there's a certain sense when you grant dual citizenship, you're letting them retain local citizenship and control much and govern much of their own local affairs. Think of the Sanhedrin at the time of Christ, the Sanhedrin in Israel. Israel was doing much themselves within Israel. They couldn't put anyone to death, right? That's where they had to go ask for permission from Pilate to put Christ to death. But they govern many things themselves. That's the idea of Rome saying, we acknowledge we can't cover everything, so therefore we'll grant dual citizenship. This is how we're going to expand and control certain things, but allow people to manage their own affairs in some things, but still be under our governance, under our jurisdiction. In dual citizenship, they retain their local citizenship as well as gain Roman citizenship, and that's similar to America's federal system of having both state citizenship and federal citizenship, right? It's the idea at America's founding to say, you know, the capital was at New York City first before Washington, D.C., when they set up the District of Columbia. But the idea is, even then, the 13 colonies were very expansive, the original 13 states. Much is going to be left to the states to govern themselves. And the federal government is a government of limited enumerated powers, Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, specific stated enumerated powers. And the rest are reserved to the states or to the people, respectively, the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Dual citizenship. That's where you and I, you say, are you a citizen of Minnesota? I say, yes. Are you a citizen of the United States? I say, yes. Dual citizenship. You know, Lord willing, when we get to America, we'll cover some of these things. But before the U.S. Civil War, the U.S. soldiers would swear an oath to these United States. Why is it General Robert E. Lee served with Virginia, the South? Because he was more loyal to his state as a citizen of Virginia than to the United States as a citizen of the United States. Okay? There could be issues then, you'll see, right? There could be loyalty issues. This is one way Rome expanded, but it also creates weaknesses, right? Because those who are non-voting citizens are less loyal, and those who have dual citizenship are less loyal. You tend to be more loyal to your local citizenship than to the one far away, okay? So it was an inherent weakness, but yet it allowed them to govern a broad, expansive area. Strengths and weaknesses, there's tension on that. One scholar, though, he said this, that classifying all the cities by their relationship to Rome after the Latin War in 338 BC, it was the most important stage in the formation of the system by which land conquered by the Romans would be organized, first in Italy, then in the Mediterranean, and ultimately the whole rest of the empire. Obviously, the American founders were paying attention. But it had weaknesses, right, as I just noted, which we found out as well with the Civil War, 1861 to 65. Now, it should be obvious to you by now that much of the history of the Roman Republic involves wars. One scholar, he wrote this, a remarkable feature of the process by which the Romans conquered Italy is that between 343 and 241 BC, so that includes the Latin War. The Latin War was 341 to 338. So, but if you look at this, about this 100-year period, 343 BC to 241 BC, Rome went to war in almost every year, excluding perhaps 5 years for which data is inconclusive. So only because data is inconclusive in 5 years over the 102 years are we not sure about five. So more than likely, though, they went to war every year, every year. But again, I want you to know we live in different times. We live in different times. When North America was colonized, the Native American Indian tribes were killing one another, left and right. Tribal warfare is common to the history of humanity. Common to the history of humanity. The exception to the rule not to have it. To have peace among different tribes. Multiculturalism, tribalism destroys nations. But this was a period of time, and same with Athens. I mean, when we traveled through Athens, through ancient Greece, all there was constant warfare and fighting. And only did they get together when a larger enemy came, remember Persia. Then they're like, okay, we better form a league here, the Delian League, and we've got to at least work together here for a while to defeat this bigger enemy. But then once that was done, then they're fighting each other again, right? In the Peloponnesian War, then you got Greeks against Greeks again. Sparta leading their league against Athens in their league, fighting it out for 27 years, from 431 to 404 BC. War was a constant thing. You study ancient Israel, what do you have? War, all the time in Jerusalem, right? All the time. I want to stress that because before we condemn the Roman Republic as nothing but a warmongering machine, going to war every year, basically, it is very important for us to understand the perilous circumstances in which they existed. For every nation at that time in human history, the consequences for losing a war were extremely severe. Peace was maintained through military strength and winning wars. There was no Geneva Convention recognizing the God-given rights of both citizens and military troops. One scholar explains the warrior mentality this way. I'll give you a long quote. The slaughter of its soldiers and the sale into slavery of those who survived were common fates visited upon a conquered army. And the sufferings inflicted upon the civilian population could be cruel in the extreme. Their movable possessions plundered and carried off, women and young boys raped, expulsion from their ancestral lands and temples, their homes occupied by their conquerors, enslavement, and even the mutilation or execution of all adult male captives. Because the consequences of defeat could be so terrible, ancient states did everything in their power to avoid it, and Republican Rome was no exception. It built up its military strength in every way it could in the hopes of deterring attacks from ever being launched in the first place, and should deterrence fail, in order to crush any enemy bold enough to march against it. It was survival. It was survival. Now, fighting continual wars, as the Romans did, required a continual supply of male soldiers. Went to war every year, basically. Mid-300s to mid-200s. You need a continual supply of male soldiers. Now think, though, the threat of military defeat to Rome encouraged anyone confronting Rome to ally with it, supplying Rome with additional soldiers. The stronger Rome became, the more anyone around them said, we better ally ourselves with them and make a treaty with them, because we're also under threat. And in making a treaty with them, gave the commitment of additional soldiers. By 264 BC, across southern Italy, if you had not been either colonized by Rome or incorporated directly into Rome, you had a military alliance with Rome by 264 BC in southern Italy. And all treaties had an essential requirement that allies provide their own contingents of soldiers to the Roman army, pay for them, and send them to Rome on demand, subject to the command of Roman generals. Say that again. All treaties had an essential element and requirement that anyone allied with Rome had to draft have a military levy their own contingents of men for the Roman army, pay for them, and send them to Rome on demand, subject to the command of Roman generals. The Roman alliance system was similar to the Delian League in Athens that we had looked at as the Greeks fought against the Persians at the beginning of the 5th century BC. But the Delian League, if you remember, slid into only an annual monetary tribute, just an annual monetary payment. And it was hundreds of millions of dollars in today's terms going to Athens from the Delian League to fund shipbuilding and the military exercise to expel and prevent the Persians from ever coming back to the area. At the beginning, the Greek city-states and the Delian League that allied themselves with Athens could supply either ship or money to pay for ships. And most of the city-states felt it not practical to be building their own ships. Athens was very good at building ships, so then they just paid them. Well, remember, that was part of the downfall in Athens in their republic because it was a democratic republic. And they wanted to keep the war effort going, in a sense, the Delian League going, because all this money could be flowing in to the military-industrial complex within Athens. So it had the perverse incentive of keeping it going. And anyone who tried to get out, remember, Athens would go militarily fight the Greek city to keep them in the Delian League. That one fell into then totally a monetary tribute, where in the case of the Roman Republic, that was not what happened. Rome wanted a fresh supply of troops all the time for the Roman legions. They wanted soldiers more than money. And in the requisitioning of troops for the Roman legions, Rome was very wise with how they requisitioned or levied troops from these various conquered city-states within Rome, the Roman Republic. So they're growing, they're expanding, and all of these, they're either incorporated directly, or they're giving non-voted citizenship, or they're in some type of an alliance, right? A treaty with them. How you levy troops when you need troops? They tried to do it in a balanced way, not to overburden any one of the cities. So Rome had a list of all of the various allies and their troops, their military soldiers. And then what the Roman Republic did was worked out a fraction of each that would be required to fill what they needed for the war effort that year, depending on how things were going. But they tried to divvy out the burden amongst all of the various city-states to keep them all from being overburdened by the sending of troops. So, in sum then, wise alliances, unique innovations of citizenship through either being colonized or directly incorporated into Rome, they granted dual citizenship of municipality. All of that allowed the Roman Republic to rapidly expand its borders and grow in power. Always gave them a fresh supply of military troops through their treaties and alliances. And by the early 3rd century, so 290s, 280s BC, they essentially control all of ancient Italy. By the early 3rd century BC, by 290s, 280s BC. Now in the 3rd and 2nd centuries, so in the 200s and the 100s BC, Rome, you know, it controls all of ancient Italy at this point. Rome then fought 3 wars against Carthage. The nation, the city-state that it formed that treaty with, remember, right when the Republic was formed in 509 BC. They had formed a treaty with Carthage, and there was another one later on. They had different treaties with Carthage. But here in the 200s and 100s BC, in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, Rome fought 3 wars against Carthage of northwest Africa. Rome won all 3 wars against Carthage, but they had to become a naval power to do it. Before this point, they had not been a massive naval power, even though they were in the Tiber River close to the Mediterranean Sea. They were known for the Roman legions, big army. But this was just like how Sparta defeated Athens in the Peloponnesian War. They had to become a naval power, and we'd covered that. Same thing here. Rome had to become what they were not at the beginning, a naval power, to defeat Carthage. Well, Rome won all three wars against Carthage. And they were fighting these wars primarily outside of Italy. That's where they're starting to expand. We have the First Punic War, it's called. First Punic War from 264 to 241 BC. They won that war and acquired the island of Sicily just south of Italy. There was the Second Punic War from 218 to 201 BC. Rome won that war against Carthage. They defeated Hannibal. You may have heard of a man named Hannibal, a general. Hannibal, I just put in there too, just for side note, he fought with elephants. Since Carthage was northwest Africa, they had access to elephants. Yet that were the tanks of the day. Imagine sitting there, how are we going to defeat the elephants coming at us? Well, that's where Rome had to figure that one out. Right? Well, Rome, in the Second Punic War, defeated Hannibal of Carthage, and they caused Carthage to lose all of its overseas territories. So when Carthage lost the Second Punic War against the Roman Republic, Carthage lost all of its overseas territories. Now notice, from the First Punic War, when that ended, about 20 years later, counting down to Christ, so the First Punic War ended 241 BC, Second Punic War began 218 BC. About 20 years later, Carthage is going to try it again against Rome. Well, that war, the Second Punic War, ended 201 BC, and about 50 years later, you have the Third Punic War. And in this one, it's like three strikes and you're out. Rome had enough. Roman Republic utterly destroyed Carthage, and many of you know they salted, literally, salted the land of Carthage so that it would never rise in power again. So that the land would never be productive, the farmland. None of it. Salt it. They were so mad and fed up with Carthage after three wars with Carthage. They were done. Now, after these three Punic Wars, Rome made several alliances and treaties with other tribes and cities across northwest Africa. And Rome then came to exercise undisputed predominance, total control throughout the lands of the Western Mediterranean after winning the Third Punic War against Carthage. From there, then, the Roman Republic went east and northwest. This is what Russell Kirk says when they went east and northwest after the Third Punic War, after 146 BC. To liberate the cities of old Greece from Macedonia. Macedonia, you know, you remember, is northeast of Greece, very southeast Europe. To liberate the cities of old Greece from Macedonia, the legions, the Roman legions, penetrated into Eastern Europe. Once established in Greece, which they occupied thoroughly, the Romans picked a quarrel with the Seleucid Empire. Remember, the Seleucid Empire was just east of Israel in Asia. And that's where the Roman Empire commenced their conquest of Asia. Let me just pause there. Nick Needham, church historian, he noted that the first record we have of the Romans and their contact with the Israelites was where they made a treaty with a military alliance. Romans made a treaty, a military alliance with Israel because their common enemy was the Seleucid Empire to the east, and that they would help one another dealing with the Seleucid Empire. So the Romans then commenced their conquest of Asia against the Seleucid Empire, and then later, led by Julius Caesar, the legions, the Roman legions, would conquer Gaul, present-day France, and land in Britain. By the late days of the Republic, the Roman Commonwealth had no very powerful external enemies left to fight. This is in the late days of the Republic. They had conquered all their main enemies in and around them. By conquering all their main enemies in and around the Mediterranean Sea and beyond, the Roman Republic gave to the world something unique after centuries of constant warfare called the Pax Romana. the Roman peace. The Pax Romana, the Roman peace. The Roman Republic was the mixed government praised by Aristotle. We had covered Aristotle and his view of the ideal polis, the ideal republic. The Roman Republic was the mixed government praised by Aristotle, but which Aristotle had thought almost impossible to maintain on a grand scale. Now, we have noted the American founders knew about the Roman Republic primarily by reading the histories of Polybius. Polybius wrote a book called The Histories. Polybius was a Greek who was born in 200 BC, died 118 BC. Lived from 200 BC to 118 BC. And he was a Greek who had been exiled in the city of Rome. Knew a lot about the city of Rome at that period of time. In the 100s, the 2nd century BC, and he wrote his book, The Histories. And you can go buy it right now and read it. And our American founders read it. And that's how they knew about the Roman Republic, along with Cicero and other works. Through Polybius, they knew quite a bit about the Roman Republic. This is what Russell Kirk says. The framers of the American Constitution would emulate the Roman model as best they could. The Roman institutions of checks and balances in politics and of separation of powers would be imitated in the frame of government for the United States. The American presidency would resemble somewhat the Roman consular imperium. The imperium is the power of the monarch, remember. Now, the seven kings during the kingdom of Rome, at the beginning, the first 250 years of Rome, they had the imperium power. And then when they removed the king, they replaced the king with two consulars. Where the American presidency would resemble somewhat the Roman consular imperium, to be the best of monarchy, the commander-in-chief. And the Senate of the United States was intended to function in part as had the Senate of Rome. Now, many of you know the senators, the U.S. senators, from 1789, when the U.S. Constitution was ratified, to 1913, U.S. senators were elected by state legislatures. They were meant to be aristocrats, old men, wise politicians, wealthy. 1913, the U.S. amended our Constitution so that it became democratic, so that individuals, all individuals, me and you, elect U.S. senators. That changed the nature of the U.S. Senate. The U.S. senators then were less concerned with protecting the rights of states. Whoever elects you, you want to look out for their interests. So if from 1789 to 1913, state legislatures elected U.S. senators, then the U.S. senators were concerned with state legislatures and protecting states' rights. Which means the U.S. senators who confirmed justices to the Supreme Court and federal judges would be very concerned not to put justices on the U.S. Supreme Court that would run roughshod over states. It totally changed our federal system from being less aristocratic and more democratic. Athens was democratic, a democratic republic. It didn't last long. That's why it makes it more unstable, the republic. Aristocratic republics last longer. Rome proved it. But a structure of civil government only goes so far. We've talked about this. If I asked and said, what was the real underlying key to Rome's success, to the Republic's success in Rome? Russell Kirk says, the secret of this universal triumph, said the admirers of the Romans, was the high old Roman virtue. And so said the Roman moralists themselves. Why? What was the real key to their success? They had virtue. Significantly, the word virtue literally means energetic manliness. Energetic manliness. That's what a republic needs to succeed and last. The feminization of America will destroy it. Energetic manliness, that's similar to the Apostle Paul's exhortation to Christians in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13. In 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13, he uses a Greek word that could be translated, be brave or act like men. The New American Standard Version says, act like men. That's this idea of virtue. We should be virtuous people. We should have energetic manliness. These are ways scholars describe the Romans with their high old Roman virtue. They were earnest, tenacious, well-disciplined, frugal, and often self-sacrificing when the state was in peril. They also valued strong marriages and families in the old Roman Republic. They valued strong marriages and families. One scholar says this, until late Republican years in Rome, their family ties were stronger perhaps than any other Western society has known. Part of it was their pagan religion and how they looked at families. Okay? Even from the time of the founding of Rome by King Romulus, a husband could put aside his wife only for very grave cause, chiefly adultery. Divorce was rare until the last century of the Roman Republic. Divorce was rare until the very last century of the Roman Republic, when it was in decline. You had family breakdown. As the Apostle Paul noted in his letter to the church at Rome, the Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts. They show the work of God's law written in their hearts, Romans 2:15. And the Romans did. They showed the high old Roman virtue. Russell Kirk says they had a sense of duty and an attachment to honesty and honor worked upon their leading men. Good to be honest, seek honor, fulfill your duty, energetic manliness. Do what's right. They had their pagan gods and goddesses, yes. And many they took from the Greeks and gave them Roman names. But they cannot erase the fact that they're created in the image of God. And God's law is written in their hearts. And God gave them a conscience. Romans 2:15. That either accuses them of wrong or defends them when they do right. Remember, just because they're pagans doesn't mean they're wrong on everything. If a pagan looks at you and says 1 + 1 = 2, you look at them and say, that's correct. The Apostle Paul quoted pagans in his sermon in Acts 17. That's recorded for us that he gave at the Areopagus in Athens. Again, as we noted, when you're thinking about this high old Roman virtue, as really the key to their success as a republic. Remember, a republic is where you govern yourself. We talked about that when we talked about Jerusalem, where Western civilization began, that really, in ancient Israel, in Jerusalem, where God was their king, God gave them His laws, and they governed themselves according to those laws. Who sat in their courts? They had to set up courts at the gates of every city in ancient Israel. Who governed? The elders. Right? They had to decide their own cases, right? Who managed the family farms? The men who owned it, right? They divvied up the land, right? The promised land. But you were managing your own farms, taking care of your own business, being responsible, governing your own affairs, and taking care of the enforcement of the law in courts, your own courts that you're administering. That's the idea of citizenship. Self-government, committed to the common good. Remember the difference between just being a subject under a king is you just do what you're told. Period. No decision-making involved at all. But a citizen involves decision-making on your own, self-government. And that's why in Israel, ancient Israel had a unique mix of both. Because when we get to the point in ancient Israel, as we said, where Solomon was governing, what? You'd take your court case to him. Say, okay, tell me the result of this, right? That's what kings did. But before that point, what did we have? We had a jury of our peers, really, the elders in ancient Israel. God wasn't the one that you immediately took your court case to and say, okay, God, decide this case with me. No, human beings had to decide the cases and controversies before them, and they had to manage their own farms and affairs. That's the idea of citizenship. Remember, just another way of saying it, I had pointed out when we went through Athens, the Greeks ridiculed the Persians. Persians were ruled by a king. Athens and the others said they would not make an alliance with Persia. We will not make any Greek a subject, a slave of a king. We are free people. We govern ourselves. It's the idea of a republic. But it takes virtue to do it. It takes morality. You have to be honest. Another word for self-government is self-control. Right? Self-control. The success of a republic depends, as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle argued, and we looked at them, but the success of a republic depends upon a self-controlled individual, a moral individual. In other words, a well-ordered republic depends upon a well-ordered human soul. If you govern yourself well and I govern myself well, when you leave your house, you're not worried about me coming over and stealing all your possessions. Because we are citizens that are self-controlled and moral. If we're a bunch of wicked people, then we require a heavy external hand to control us. But if we are self-controlled, self-governed, it takes a small government. Because we take care of our own affairs. We provide for our own families. We work with our own hands, right? For a republic to last, it depends upon a moral and virtuous people. That was repeated over and over again by the American founders. And that's why when Benjamin Franklin walked down the steps after the Constitutional Convention in September of 1787 and a woman asked him, "What have you given us?" He said, "We've given you a republic if you can keep it." If you can keep it. And the founders over and over again said it depends upon a moral and religious people. Now think, if the high old Roman virtue helped it last for 400 years, the Republic, if that was the real key, the virtue of its people, if that was the true underlying key to Rome's success as a Republic, then its decline was hastened and caused by a decline in virtue. Well, writing his histories in the 100s BC, Polybius foresaw Rome's decadence. Polybius believed that military success brings military prosperity, which brings arrogance and luxury. And from there, greedy avarice. I want more. Easy money. And that changes the character of the people. The view was, we as human beings don't handle prosperity well. What controls you when everything goes well? And you've gotten plunder through military victories? What controls you to back off when you did it for survival and your security because you don't want to lose and get mutilated and raped? So you build up your biggest military and fight every war you can to defeat every enemy to survive, and you survive. And you're on top. And you have the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. There are no big external enemies now. Now what? Can you control yourself in all this prosperity? Several scholars, this is their assessment, Russell Kirk, said this: the chief material cause of the Roman Republic's decay appears to have been the military success of its armies and the expansion of Roman territories and power. The three Punic Wars ruin the majority of the Roman peasants, either through death in the hundreds of thousands or by returning overburdened by debt. Victor Davis Hanson agrees, describing the decline of the Roman Republic as a kind of imperial corruption. This is in a speech Victor Davis Hanson gave at Hillsdale College. He stated this, referring to Arnold Toynbee, who was a historian, died 1975. Arnold Toynbee wrote a two-volume work on Hannibal's legacy. He called it Hannibal's Legacy, published 1965. But this is what Victor Davis Hanson says, referring to Arnold Toynbee. In historian Arnold Toynbee's two-volume work, Hannibal's Legacy, he argued that the period in which Rome fought the three Punic Wars, an era in which Rome achieved mastery of almost the entire Western Mediterranean, was almost ultimately calamitous for Rome because it undermined Rome's republican habits, virtues, and character. The Roman people, Toynbee argued, especially the independent yeomen, the plebe farmers, were sent off for long periods to fight as legionaries in places like Spain and Numidia, present-day Libya. Their places were taken. Who's going to manage the farms then? Their places were taken by some 2 million slaves from conquered provinces who were shipped back to Italy. Huge amounts of money extracted from conquered lands poured into Italy and enriched an elite class whose members consolidated the farms of the soldiers who were fighting abroad and forged them into large estates worked by slaves. Corruption of the elite. In time, Victor Davis Hanson continues, in time, the troops overseas, whose successes had been due to the Italian virtues of hard work, independence, autonomy, and agrarianism that one sees emphasized in Virgil's, the Roman poet Virgil, he died 19 BC, in Virgil's Eclogues and Georgics, his poems, he spoke of the Italian virtues of hard work, independence, autonomy, and agrarianism. Instead of those Italian virtues, they became accustomed to plunder. Let's just defeat a city and plunder it of its wealth. Steal. When Carthage finally fell in 146 BC, its population of 50,000, down from 500,000, was enslaved, and the city was razed to its foundations. That's where it was all assaulted. That same year, the Romans looted and destroyed Corinth, the cultural capital of Greece. Corinth was no security threat to Rome. That same year, the Romans looted and destroyed Corinth, the cultural capital of Greece. The Rome of Virgil, Catullus, the younger Cato, and Cicero was now busy obliterating defeated cities that posed little threat to Rome's security. It was no longer just survival. It was about plunder and stealing, easy wealth. In addition, as to say why their virtues collapsed, why men became more evil than they otherwise were, let's put it that way. Once Greece was under the control of Rome, many Greek sophists immigrated to Rome, and their philosophies undermined the old Roman pietists. We had talked about the sophists. We spent quite a bit of time on them. Socrates was responding against the sophists, Plato and Aristotle as well. Remember, the sophists were relativists. They were subjectivists. Man the measure. They had the idea, some of the sophists, that whatever you perceive is your reality and your truth, whatever I perceive is my reality and my truth. They spoke like a common Democrat today. Okay? That's the woke, the idea of if I identify as a woman, that's my perception. You can identify as whatever you want to. That's the idea of the sophists. Words are just playthings. Total rhetoricians. Everything's relative. Everything's personal perception. No objective reality and truth. That was the sophists. And Socrates wrote against and says, no, there's objective reality. There's objective truth. Plato wrote against them and so did Aristotle, but they had their different arguing for objective reality and truth as we looked into them. But these sophists, once Greece was overcome by the Roman Republic, many of those sophists immigrated to Rome and took their subjectivism and relativism to Rome. If alive at that time, I'm sure that Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle would have argued that the immigration of sophist subjectivism and relativism helped undermine the high old Roman virtue. There's no such thing really as honesty. Why be honorable? Why self-sacrifice? Interestingly, Cicero, who lived 106 to 43 BC, that's who we're moving into then, eventually, Cicero. He lived 106 to 403 BC. Cicero pondered why the Roman Republic declined, asking, was it that men were worse than formerly, or that bad laws had corrupted the commonwealth? Is it just men are worse, or do we blame bad laws? Cicero answered the question by arguing that the Roman Republic's decline was primarily because men were worse, but that does not mean laws are irrelevant. Cicero basically said, there cannot be a good commonwealth unless most citizens are virtuous, and the citizens find it difficult to hold by the old morality in a time of political disorder and corruption. So there is a sense in which the polis, as we have said, is the human soul writ large. That was Plato's view, that was Aristotle's view. What is the polis, the political society, the good republic? Is the human soul writ large. The republic will be good if the human soul is good. The republic depends upon a moral citizenry for success and long-term preservation. That's what Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle argued for. But corrupt laws of the polis promote corruption in the citizenry. If you have laws that encourage laziness and subsidize laziness, what do you think is going to happen? Do you end up with energetic manliness? No, you end up with a bunch of men that want to sit on their butt and play video games all day. That's all you end up with. And you're subsidizing laziness. The republic will certainly fall. Citizens like you and me will have a harder time maintaining true virtue in the face of corrupt laws. That's Cicero's assessment. After the destruction of Carthage in 146 BC, at the end of the Third Punic War, the Romans begin to destroy one another, rend each other apart. This is what one scholar said. Class against class, allies against the claims of Rome, slaves against their masters, provinces against Roman garrisons, general against general, senate against people. Between 133 and 121 BC, two political reformers arose, they failed, and were killed. Italian cities rebelled against Rome in the Social War. It's called the Social War from 90 BC to 88 BC. Italian cities rebelled against Rome. Then two political parties arose, dragging the Roman Republic into a very destructive and violent 7-year civil war. At one point, a man named Marius gained control of Rome, killing his opponents, but was succeeded by Sulla, a man named Sulla, who was a ruthless dictator supported by the Senate. Then the Asiatic provinces were overrun by Mithridates, king of Pontus. Restoring order seemed out of reach at this point. From 73 to 71 BC, Roman slaves arose in a revolt led by the gladiator Spartacus. It was called the Servile War. The Servile War. From 73 to 71 BC, Roman slaves arose in a revolt led by the gladiator Spartacus. Many of you are familiar with that name. Russell Kirk summarizes it well that by this time, he said, quote, Italy lay in misery, unquote. At this point, Italy lay in misery. Amid this misery in Italy arose in Rome what is called the First Triumvirate. The First Triumvirate. Pompey the Great, Julius Caesar, and Crassus. Pompey the Great was a military general who had reconquered Asia. How do we restore order here? And this is where three powerful generals rose up and said, we'll try and restore order here. Pompey the Great was a military general who had reconquered Asia. Julius Caesar, as we said, conquered Gaul, present-day France, and then went and landed in Britain. Julius Caesar is described by Russell Kirk as a bankrupt young man of genius turned demagogue. That's Julius Caesar. A bankrupt young man of genius turned demagogue. And Crassus was a rich general who successfully put down the revolt of the slaves, led by Spartacus in the Servile War. So Crassus was a rich general who successfully put down the revolt of the slaves. So in a sense, then they're regaining some order here. Trying. Now, during these tumultuous years of the Roman Republic's decline, from the Social War, 90 to 88 BC, through both the Seven-Year Civil War and the Servile War of 73 to 71 BC, to the First Triumvirate, Cicero lived during this period of time. Cicero lived from 106 to 43 BC, when Italy lay in misery. Cicero lived. A man whose writings were well known among the American founders, aspired to emulate the massive, long-lasting Roman Republic that Cicero wrote about. Russell Kirk states this, "This is the period of Roman history that was best known to Americans of the 18th century." America's founding, 1776. "It was the time of Marcus Tullius Cicero, a philosopher and statesman, consul and rhetorician. Directly or indirectly, the mind and life of Cicero are bound up with the American understanding of order, more than are the thought and action of any other man of classical times." I'll read that again. "This is the period of Roman history that was best known to Americans of the 18th century. It was the time of Marcus Tullius Cicero, philosopher and statesman, consul and rhetorician. Directly or indirectly, the mind and life of Cicero are bound up with the American understanding of order, more than are the thought and action of any other man of classical times." Now think in your mind of when Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle wrote. In Athens, at its chaotic time of decline, during and after the Peloponnesian War, that was from 431 to 404 BC, amid widespread relativistic sophist ideas, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle defended the idea of order, both in the material world and in man's social relationships, the polis. Similarly, Cicero defended an idea of order amid the chaotic civil wars at the end of the Roman Republic. So, the next time we meet, Lord willing, we'll pick up our journey through Western civilization, pondering in more detail Cicero, who lived 106 to 43 BC, and his view on the law of nature. Lord willing, the next time we meet.